The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Bill Sasso, and I am chairman of the Free Library Foundation. Before beginning tonight's program, I would like to take care of a few housekeeping items. First of all, I'd like to encourage all of you to get a free library card and learn about the many services and programs that the library has to offer. And while we cherish the fact that this is always will be considered the free library, if you could consider making a gift of any size in order that we might continue our community involvement, we would greatly appreciate that. In addition, I'd like all of you to check your cell phones. I know you probably did before you came in, but check them again, please, just to make sure they're off. And I'd also like to remind you that there will be a book signing in the lobby immediately after the speech and the question and answer. And last housekeeping item, please remember to keep your questions short and focused. We don't like to have the questions to be a platform to you for you to express a political idea or thought or theory. So just keep them short and focused, and I'm sure you'll get an excellent answer. And now it is my pleasure this evening to introduce our guest author and former ambassador, Dennis Ross. Ambassador Ross is the Ziegler Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and for more than 12 years, he played a leading role in shaping United States involvement in the Middle East peace process, dealing directly with the parties in negotiations. He is a highly skilled diplomat, and Mr. Ross was this country's point person in the peace process in both the George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations. He was instrumental in helping Israelis and Palestinians reach the 1995 interim agreement, and he successfully brokered the 1997 Hebron Accord, and he facilitated the 1994 Israel-Jordan Peace Treaty. Charged for over a decade with educating presidents and the Congress on all matters dealing with the Middle East, Ambassador Ross is that rare figure respected and trusted by both Republicans and Democrats alike. Dennis Ross's first book, The Missing Peace, The Inside Story of the Fight for Middle East Peace, was hailed by President Clinton as the definitive and gripping account of the Middle East peace process, and by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright as a brilliant behind-the-scenes account of history in the making. Now, with Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World, Ambassador Ross explores the practice of negotiations and the importance of multilateralism as a means rather than as an end. A contributor to the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the New Republic, who also appears regularly on National Public Radio and Fox News, we are honored to have him here with us in Philadelphia. And please join me in welcoming Ambassador Dennis Ross.
Thank you. You know, when I was thinking about writing this book, I thought I was going to write a book just on negotiations. And the reason I thought that is, having written The Missing Peace, which is really the story of an effort to negotiate peace over a long period of time, there was a lot in that story that basically told you how to negotiate, told you a lot about the rhythm of negotiations and the like. And I thought, you know, maybe I should just write a book on negotiations, because most of the people who write on negotiations have actually never done it. So I said, how novel. Maybe someone who's actually been a practitioner should write about it. And I was going to do that. I was. In fact, there are four chapters in this book on when, why, and what to negotiate, and then there's a chapter on how to negotiate, actually 12 rules for how to negotiate, and then there's a when, what, and why to mediate, and then how to mediate, 11 rules on how to mediate. And these are, in fact, instruments of statecraft. But I thought, as I looked at American foreign policy, I said, there's something profoundly missing right now. And what's missing is statecraft. Now, when I use the word statecraft, I'm going to involve you in this discussion. When I use the word statecraft, most people have an image of what it is. What they think it is they think it relates basically to the instrumentalities that a state has to be able to pursue its interests and to protect itself. So let's play a little game. Let's assume the next administration is really good at knowing how to use diplomacy and execute it, and is really good at knowing how to manipulate coercion, and is really good at knowing how to take advantage of our economic resources to use economic power to affect behavior, and is really professional and expert at using intelligence, and is really good, I know, you're all choked up. I've only just begun and already you're choked up. I realize you're comparing it to what we currently have. I'm not trying to turn this into a fictional account. I'm still trying to establish a certain principle here. The principle here is the next administration is excellent in all these areas of hard power, soft power, of informational usage. So you're talking about basically economic strength, diplomatic capability, military wherewithal, intelligence that can be used as a vehicle for enhancing your position and for achieving influence. And the same with information, how you talk about issues, how you frame issues. Let's assume the next administration is really good at all those, knows how to integrate all those tools as well. It's not just that it can do each of them independently or individually, but actually it integrates them in a way that actually reflects a kind of capability and professionalism. Would that be an administration that's good at statecraft? This is just a simple question. All right, the answer is yes. Is that most people here? All right, so I have people who are really serious. I see that. Well, some people are saying yes, some people are saying define statecraft. I'm going to. My point here is to think about it. If you say yes, let me just ask you another question. This administration that I've just described as being expert at being able to manipulate, orchestrate, integrate all of these different tools and instruments and assets of the state, what if it's in the service of objectives that make no sense? Would it be good statecraft then? Okay. So let's flip it. What if we have a next administration that really understands what our role in the world should be, defines our purposes very well, is very clear on the objectives, and they're the right objectives, but it doesn't know how to execute them. It doesn't know how to use any of those instrumentalities I was talking about before. It's not good at, in a sense, integrating all these tools. It's not going to be very good at statecraft either, is it? So what is already revealed? You ask the question of the definition of statecraft. Well, good statecraft always marries objectives and means. Bad statecraft always has a mismatch between objectives and means. How do you think we're doing in Iraq? Let's just look at the beginning of Iraq, not the whole story. Our objective in Iraq was to deal with the threat of weapons of mass destruction. Well, no, that's what the administration. Well, look, I'm prepared to make the presentation. We can have a dialogue later, okay? The administration's objective going in, its announced objective going in, was to rid the place of the threat of weapons of mass destruction. That was its objective. But it didn't even apply the means to achieve that objective. We happened to be very lucky there were no weapons of mass destruction. Why? We didn't have enough forces on the ground to be able to seize all the sites we thought had WMD. And we certainly didn't have enough forces on the ground to prevent the smuggling out of the country of all the WMD, if it had existed. So here was a fundamental gap between our objectives and our means. That was the first indication that we weren't doing so well in statecraft when it came to Iraq. But, of course, there were others. What was the fundamental problem in Iraq? The fundamental problem in Iraq was that there was a faith-based assessment, not a reality-based assessment. If you're going to shape objectives and means that are going to fit together and not be divided, not have a fundamental mismatch, one of the things you have to have is you have to have reality-based assessments that inform your objective and will also inform the means that either you have or others have that you can draw on or try to mobilize. What was the faith-based assessment in Iraq? Well, the faith-based assessment in Iraq was all we had to do was cut off the head of the snake and everything would be fine. The administration's assumption was when Saddam Hussein falls, everything falls into place, it doesn't fall apart. What's the proof of that? The proof is that the Secretary of Defense told the people around him and informed Jake Garner, who was going to be the first administrator, that we would draw down from 160,000 troops to 25,000 troops in about 3.5 months. Now, you know, it takes that long to build up this number of forces. It takes you, when you're withdrawing on that pace, you're doing it in a very precipitous way. So the assumption was everything falls into place, it doesn't fall apart. That was completely divorced from the reality. Was it unknowable to understand that there would be an insurgency in Iraq? Was it unknowable to see that there might be a sectarian or even civil war in Iraq? Was it unknowable that there would be a vacuum in Iraq when Saddam Hussein fell? And vacuums in the Middle East are always, without exception, filled by violence. None of that was unknowable. But there was a groupthink. There was an ideologically driven assessment, a faith-based assessment. There was wishful thinking. There wasn't a reality-based assessment. There were people in the administration, by the way, who were making some of these arguments, but they weren't listened to because the administration thought it knew best, and basically not only the world, but the administration itself was divided between believers and non-believers. I mean, one example, and I talk about it in the Iraq chapter in the book, one example is that the CIA wanted to run a simulation on what would happen when Saddam Hussein fell. And the Pentagon refused to allow anybody from the Pentagon to take part in the simulation. Why? By the way, all of my questions I can answer. I just want you to know that. I may pose a lot of questions, but I can answer them all. How I do in your questions, we'll see. But my questions, I'm golden on my questions. All right, so why? Why is it that the Pentagon wouldn't allow anybody to participate? Because they thought the people sponsoring the CIA simulation were against going to war. And therefore, they didn't want to take part in it because all they were going to do is raise problems. Well, think about what that means. I mean, really, think about it. Take a step back and think about it. Wouldn't you think that if you're about to do something where you're committing American forces, wouldn't you think it would be in your interest to actually hear what your critics have to say and to be able to answer every one of the problems or questions they raise? Because this way you'll know you've anticipated everything. But no, what did they do? They're going to raise problems. So what happened in the administration is anybody who was raising questions was discredited. But it wasn't just the people who were discredited. It was their questions that were discredited. And when that's the case, you have faith-based assessments. When you have faith-based assessments, you have a gap in your mindset, you have a gap in your objectives and your means, because you're only going to be able to shape objectives that make sense if they're connected to reality. And the same with your means. You're not going to know what are the right means if you don't understand the reality. Now, again, we're playing this out now in terms of a statecraft approach. So we've started by saying statecraft is about being able to marry your objectives and your means. And we understand that to be able to marry our objectives and our means, we have to have reality-based assessments, not faith-based assessments. Okay? Okay so far? You with me so far? You like the notion of statecraft so far? Okay, good. In conclusion, no, all right. So here we have an understanding that reality-based assessments are important. Now, reality-based assessments don't mean that you have to limit your ambition when it comes to objectives. I said reality-based assessments should inform your objectives. They don't have to limit your objectives. You can still be ambitious. You can decide that the reality that exists today is a reality you want to change. But you can't change the reality until you understand it. So if you're going to have ambitious objectives, that's okay. Statecraft doesn't mean you can't look to try to change things for the better. But it means you have to understand that I know what I can deal with today, and I know what means I might have to be able to do it, and what I have to do is figure out how I'm going to change the circumstances so what I can achieve today I can achieve over time. Now, how do I deal with changing a situation? Well, the first thing I have to do is I have to understand what means do I have, and I have to understand what means do others have. And if I'm in an adversarial relationship where I'm trying to change the behavior of the adversary, I have to understand the vulnerabilities of the adversary. So let me take a case, which, by the way, I take in the book. I have a chapter on how to prevent Iran from going nuclear. So let's go ahead and apply this model, this approach, to Iran. Let's start with a reality-based assessment of where we are in Iran. First things first. Understand that Iran wants nuclear weapons. At least the Iranian leadership across the board wants nuclear weapons. The best proof of that is that we have within the Iranian leadership, we have confrontationalists who represent the Revolutionary Guard, and President Ahmadinejad is one of those who believes in confrontation. And they believe in confrontation because they think, number one, the outside world always backs down. Number two, they believe confrontation on the outside creates a kind of tension that justifies their having leverage and control on the inside. That's the first constituency. Second constituency are the mullahs. And the mullahs, they just want to preserve their power and their privilege. You know, that being in charge has been good to them. Their emblem is Rafsanjani. Rafsanjani's a mullah. He became very wealthy as a mullah. I mean, most people wouldn't think that being a mullah is a passport to wealth, but it turns out he's very wealthy. Turns out having a monopoly on pistachios turns out to be a good thing. So, you know, he's basically someone who likes pistachios, and he's a mullah, and he wants to preserve his pistachio monopoly and the well-being of the mullahs. They're the second constituency. The third constituency in the elite are the liberalizers associated with the former President Khatami. And they aren't fighting the idea of an Islamic-based state, but their position is basically they'll do better, they'll flourish more if you liberalize the system. You open it up. Now, Khatami, a liberalizer, presided over a secret nuclear program, just the way Rafsanjani did. They had a nuclear program they kept hidden for 17 years. And by the way, we aren't the ones who discovered it. It was the Iranian opposition that revealed it. The IAEA was in there because they're the nuclear watchdog agency. Iran had signed up to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and they were obligated to reveal all their nuclear-related activities, and those nuclear-related activities they kept hidden. So all of the members of the elite, even though you have different constituencies, all of them want nuclear weapons. And by the way, you're not going to induce them to giving up nuclear weapons. And I say that because there's no combination of inducements that are worth as much to them as having nuclear weapons. So again, I'm giving you a realistic lay of the land. Does that mean it's impossible to persuade them or dissuade them from going nuclear? It does not. Because while they all want nuclear weapons, they aren't all willing to pursue nuclear weapons at any price. The Revolutionary Guard is. The mullahs and the liberalizers are not. And they're not because, from their standpoint, they need to ensure Iran doesn't become isolated, and they need to ensure that Iran doesn't get cut off economically. They need to ensure that because if they don't have an economy that is functioning relatively well, they aren't in a position where they can preserve social tranquility. They know they don't exactly have a popular regime. They know they have to maintain very large subsidies to preserve social peace. Now, if they get cut off economically, guess what happens? They're in trouble. What are the signs that they're aware of being in trouble? Well, first of all, one indication of their own sense of vulnerability, you think that arresting 5 Iranian Americans is a sign of feeling confident internally? None of the people they've arrested, by the way, are about confrontation. They're all about engagement. One of the last people they arrested is someone who works for George Soros and is open society. I can assure you, if I was going to create a list of 1 to 1 billion of the people who want to confront Iran, George Soros is at 1 billion. This is not what he's interested in doing. And yet they arrested someone who represents him. Why? because they fear, they themselves say it publicly, they fear what they call a velvet revolution, an effort to subvert them through opening up their society in a way that creates civil institutions that challenge them. This is not the behavior of a regime that feels highly confident. That's point one. Point two, last year, exactly one year ago, the British, the French, and the Germans offered an inducement, an incentives package to Iran. Included in that incentives package to give up their nuclear program were two light water reactors, or light water reactors. Light water nuclear reactors are very good at generating electricity. They're very bad at generating fissile material. And Iran's answer to this offer was to quote Nancy Reagan. They just said no. Now, not only did they just say no, but there was no debate among their elite that emerged in saying no. Now, when we began to talk about sanctions, which began in October, suddenly Rafsanjani released a secret letter that Ayatollah Khomeini had written in 1988 to justify why he was ending the war with Iraq. And the commentary on this secret letter that Rafsanjani had released in the Iranian press, the Iranian media, was that this showed Ayatollah Khomeini, sort of the icon of the revolution, he understood, in their words, that sometimes you have to adjust your ideology to fit reality. Might be a lesson for others as well. I'll let you draw your own conclusions about that. But it's obvious that their criticism was directed at Ahmadinejad, the president. Now, as I said, no debate when inducements were turned down. Suddenly, when sanctions are being talked about at the Security Council, a debate begins to emerge. On December 23rd, a sanctions resolution was adopted at the Security Council. And then the debate became much more public. Ahmadinejad was in one of the newspapers, which is associated with the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, which, if you think about it, it's a nice title. Supreme Leader? I don't know. It appeals to me, but not going to happen. Anyway, one of the newspapers associated with Ali Khamenei, that newspaper said Ahmadinejad is doing on the nuclear issue activities designed to divert attention away from the failings of his policies. Rather interesting thing to appear in the media. Now, we got a sense in the lay of the land that I'm describing that there is unanimity on having nuclear weapons if it's cost-free. There isn't unanimity if it's going to cost you something. We have divisions in the Iranian leadership that demonstrate that there's a potential to change their behavior. That's the good news. Now the bad news. Their behavior hasn't changed. We have today a mismatch in our objectives and our means, again, on the Iranian issue. Why? We want to prevent them from going nuclear, but today we have slow-motion diplomacy at the Security Council. We have fast-paced nuclear development by the Iranians. And don't take my word for it. The head of the IAEA, Dr. Albaradei, the director of the IAEA, announced last week that Iran will have 8,000 centrifuges by the end of the year. Now, let me explain what this is. This is a brief tutorial on what's known as a fuel cycle is all about. If you want, there are several different ways to create fissile material for the core of a nuclear warhead or bomb. You can do it through having heavy water plants, which, by the way, Iran is developing at a place called Arak. But this is to develop that reactor, it's a long process. It'll take them another 10 to 13 years. You separate out of heavy water plutonium. So that's one way to generate it. Another way, which is a much more efficient way, much quicker way, is to enrich uranium. So when you hear people talk about the fuel cycle, what they mean is you take uranium ore out of the ground. You convert it from ore into a gas called hexafluoride. You feed that hexafluoride into what are known as centrifuges, which spin it really fast. Now, you spin it fast enough, you can create fuel to fuel a reactor for electricity, or you spin it even faster, you can enrich the uranium to what's known as weapons grade. Centrifuges are the key to being able to enrich uranium. We have said they can't enrich uranium. If they have 3,000 centrifuges that are operating full-time, within 9 months they have fissile material, enough fissile material for one nuclear warhead. If they have 8,000 centrifuges by the end of the year, that means do the math. It means they can begin to create three warheads a year. And their objective is to have 54,000 centrifuges. So that means they could have a very significant nuclear weapons program. Now, it doesn't mean they're there yet, because even though Al-Baradei says they're going to have 8,000 centrifuges by the end of the year, doesn't mean they've totally solved the technological problems yet. Hexafluoride has to be very pure when it's fed into these centrifuges. The centrifuges are very delicate in terms of how they operate. If you have contaminated hexafluoride, it corrupts the machine and it doesn't work well. It's clear they're still wrestling with that. But what's also clear is they're building the centrifuges at a rate where they'll retrofit. And it's also clear that basically what we're talking about is they're going to solve their technological problems probably within the next 6 months. So if you're going to head them off, then you have to realize this is not the time for slow-motion diplomacy. You're going to have fast-paced diplomacy to keep up with the fast-paced nuclear development. Can we do it? How many people here think we can do it through diplomatic means? All right, well, that's a different issue. We're not talking about this administration, although we'll get back to it. I'm going to give you three ways for us to succeed in doing this. Each of the ways I'm going to suggest to you, again, get back to the issue I talked about at the outset. We talked about how you marry objectives and means. We talked about doing reality-based assessments. And the key to changing the behavior of others is to exert leverage. Leverage is an essential element of statecraft. Now, if you have your own means to do it or other means to do it, you try to marry or mobilize the kinds of means that can change the behaviors of others by exercising leverage. I'm going to give you three suggestions, three pathways to changing Iranian behavior. First, and when I say it, I'm banking on the fact that we can ratchet up the pressure on Iran that plays upon their vulnerabilities. What I didn't say is what their economic vulnerabilities are. They have very high inflation. They have very high unemployment. Their stock market has plummeted. They are in a position right now where their oil output, their natural gas output, is actually declining, which is the key to the revenues they need for subsidies. They need massive investment from the outside to upgrade their infrastructure for oil and natural gas. They need massive technology transfer. They need massive credits to get investment from the outside. So they're highly vulnerable to an economic cutoff. And as I said, at least two-thirds of their leadership is highly sensitive to the consequences of being cut off. So our key, the key to us succeeding now, exerting leverage, is to get to produce that economic cutoff. And who's the key to the economic cutoff? It's the Europeans and the Japanese. Last year, the Europeans provided $18 billion in loan guarantees for businesses doing business in Iran. All right, three ways for us to succeed. First way, Saudi Arabia. The Saudis view Iran with nuclear weapons as being almost as much of a threat as the Israelis do. The Saudis do it because they say Iran with nuclear weapons will have a shield behind which they can engage in coercion and subversion. And the Sunni-Shia divide, the competition which has been made far more acute by the reality of Iraq, is what is uppermost in the Saudi minds. Now, the Saudis have enormous, shall I underscore the word enormous, financial holdings in Europe. So if the Saudis, if we were to basically go to the Saudis and say, let's work out a common approach to deal with the European banks, the European investment houses, and the European governments. If the Saudis suddenly were to go there and say, if you continue to do business, if you don't cut off the Iranians, guess what? We're not going to do business with you. We've got lots of alternatives. You want to concentrate the European minds very quickly? I promise you that will do it. So that's pathway number one. Pathway number two. You have Israelis send senior military teams to Europe and say to them, you're embarked on a pathway right now that is going to produce an Iran with nuclear weapons. You fear the use of force against Iran, given its consequences, more than you fear an Iran with nuclear weapons. You think you can live with an Iran with nuclear weapons. We can't. Not, by the way, because we don't want to, but because they won't let us live. The week before last, Dr. Ahmadinejad once again said, the countdown to the destruction of Israel is begun. Except he didn't quite say that. He said the countdown to the destruction of the Zionist regime has begun. So you're Israel, and you're hearing the president of the country say that. And by the way, it's not new. He says it all the time. He says it all the time, and they're developing the means to do it. Rafsanjani, who I described as, you know, the emblem, the leader of the mullahs In the year 2001, he said, it only takes one nuclear bomb to destroy Israel. It would take vastly more to destroy us. Now, he's the pragmatist. So you're Israel. Are you going to sit back and say, well, it's okay, we'll just treat it as words? I don't think so. So what the Israelis say is, it's clear, they won't let us live. If you want to reduce the chance of using force, you have to ratchet up the pressure, because the path you're on makes force more likely, not less likely. So one way to affect the Europeans is concentrate their mind with the Saudi financial leverage. A second way to affect the Europeans is to get the Israelis to say, the very thing you don't want to see happen, the use of force, you're making more likely unless you ratchet up and cut off the economic lifeline. And I'll offer you a third way. The Europeans believe, and by the way, they're not wrong in the belief, they believe that the only way to do a deal with the Iranians in the end is to have the U.S. at the table. Because the one critical element for the Europeans is recognizing that Iran needs to have certain security assurances from us. The whole Iranian mindset, the whole view of the world is shaped by a certain narrative that the U.S. is out to change the regime. I'm not saying, you know, Henry Kissinger once said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not coming after you. And the Iranians probably embody that sentiment pretty clearly. So since they believe the U.S. has to be at the table, and the Europeans say in their own mind the U.S. has to be at the table, what we should do right now is go to the Europeans and say, look, if you will cut the economic lifeline, we're prepared to go and join you at negotiations once you do that. Now understand, we have a condition today. Our condition today is Iran has to suspend uranium enrichment. And if they suspend the uranium enrichment, then we'll join them at the table. I would not be in favor of having us drop that condition and impose no others. If we were to drop that condition, the message we would send the Iranians is, we're desperate. When you go into a negotiation, I'm a big believer that you engage. I think it's a mistake not to engage at least governments. I have a different attitude on Hamas, and maybe we'll have a discussion about that in the Q&A. But basically, I think when it comes to governments, it's a mistake not to talk to them. But don't talk to them in a way where you convince them that you need them more than they need you. When Condi Rice, the week before the Sharm el-Sheikh conference on Iraq, announced twice she really hoped the Iranian foreign minister would come, because this was at a time when the Iranians were not equivocating over coming, they were equivocating over the level. Why should she care about the level? What was the message she was sending when she said, I really hope the foreign minister will come? Well, in Iranian ears, I'll tell you what they heard. They need us. Ahmadinejad, after that, came out and gave a speech, the Americans approached us 41 times. What do you think that sends? I talked about leverage. That ain't the way to have leverage. What we're doing here is saying, all right, we will give up the condition for suspending uranium enrichment to talk, but the price is you have to cut the economic lifeline, because we want to concentrate the Iranian minds on what they're going to lose. And if they're focused enough on what they're going to lose, we then have to create a pathway for them to say, here's what you can gain. That's the essence. Leverage is about positive and negative use of your instruments. It's incentives and disincentives. It's sticks and carrots. With the Iranians, I would focus on the sticks but marry it to the carrots. I wouldn't start with the carrots, because then they think you need them more than they need you. The reason you use this third approach with the Europeans is because you're asking the Europeans to do something hard for them. They've been reluctant to impose this kind of pressure on the Iranians, partly because they have businesses that profit from it, but more importantly because they see it as a slippery slope to confrontation. Now, having the Saudis use their leverage will help. Having the Israelis play upon certain fears will help. But if we're asking them to do something hard for them, you've got to give them something at the same time. That's the essence of statecraft. So what have I just done for you? I've shown you that if you are clear in your objectives, you understand the context, the reality you're dealing with, you shape your objectives accordingly, you understand, because of your assessment, where you have means of your own and means of others. You understand where you have leverage and where the other side has vulnerabilities. And you marshal all those means to be able to exploit your leverage. That's the essence of statecraft. I'll give you one last important element of statecraft. You have to talk about issues in a certain way. You have to frame issues in a certain way. The president says, if Iran has nuclear weapons, it'll be destabilizing. You persuaded by that? I'm not. And if I'm not, who else is going to be? I mean, I'm a pretty good measure in this regard. But what if you were to say, when Iran goes nuclear, the Middle East goes nuclear? Saudi Arabia, if Iran goes nuclear, Saudi Arabia will get nuclear weapons. By the way, again, it's not my, this is not just my argument. Saudis a couple of months ago used the exact same language as Iran to say, you know, they need nuclear power. There's no doubt they're conditioning the environment that they'll do it if the Iranians have it. They're not going to allow Iran to gain that kind of leverage over them. They probably already have a deal with Pakistan and AQ Khan. I wouldn't have the slightest doubt. They already have done that deal. Now, do you think if Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons, do you believe that the Egyptians will say, it's okay, we'll allow the Saudis to be the only Arab country that has nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
What do you think the odds are of that? High probability, right? A couple of months ago, a very senior Egyptian official said to me, if Iran goes nuclear, it's the end of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. So you not only, if Iran goes nuclear, you not only have a nuclear Middle East. You're going to have the end of a regime. When this regime was adopted, the expectation was within 15 or 20 years, we'd have 20 or 30 nuclear countries. Today, we have 8 or 9, depending on how you count. If we have a world of 20 or 30 nuclear countries, we have a world that becomes far less predictable, far more prone to miscalculation, far more likely to have countries operating on a hair trigger. It is a world that is vastly more dangerous, vastly more unsettled. Now, how about you frame the issue that way? With the Europeans, by the way, you frame the issue that way, the Europeans who believe in international regimes are much more likely to understand in their own terms and, again, for their own publics. Because you're framing issues, especially for democracies, in ways that their publics will accept as well. So marry your objectives and your means. Have reality-based, not faith-based assessments. Understand how to mobilize others to build leverage. Understand where, in fact, vulnerabilities lie. Understand as well how to frame issues so you'll be more successful in convincing and persuading others. You do all those things, and you've got a pretty good approach to statecraft. Why did I write this book? I wrote this book because I want this book to create a discussion on the term. I want statecraft to be a concept that is understood and not a slogan just to be talked about. I want those who are running for the presidency to begin to answer during the campaign, what are their objectives or the purposes of the United States? How do they see those objectives or purposes married to the means we have available? What will they do to build the likelihood that others will follow and accept what we do? I want them not to treat statecraft as a slogan. Now, if I succeed, and you'll help me succeed, because you've got to start talking about it. It has to be something that is talked about. You have to create a buzz about it. If we collectively succeed, then I will have met all of my purposes in writing this book. Thank you very much. Now, we will take questions. And I am told that to wait until you have a mic. So I'm going to recognize people, but wait until you get the mic. Right here on the left. My left, your right. Not a political statement, just an observation.
Is Joe Lieberman currently building our leverage, or is he undermining it with Iran?
Well, what Joe Lieberman said, he didn't link necessarily to the nuclear issue. He linked it to the fact that they're responsible for killing American soldiers right now, and they're doing it with a kind of impunity from in Iraq. I would say he actually, what he says probably plays on the fears of Europeans. And I think right now the Europeans need to know the path they're on makes force, which they fear, pretty fundamentally, more likely, not less likely. So I think from that standpoint it probably helps. It doesn't hurt. Down here in front. I had to recognize this person because she's the mother of a former student of mine, so it just goes with the territory.
Thank you. Could you talk for a minute on Hamas and Fatah? I mean, we could probably talk for a long time, but
yeah.
What's going on and what should be going on?
Okay, so the question was on Hamas and Fatah. Well, look, Fatah's problem all along has been that Fatah is characterized by being completely corrupt. In the eyes of the Palestinian public, they're completely corrupt. when I see the administration right now immediately embracing Abu Mazen, I understand it at one level, but I'm a little bit worried about it at another. Because you can't just throw money at it and somehow treat Abu Mazen and Fatah as if nothing has changed. I had an article in the Wall Street Journal the day before yesterday where I said, we need to recognize what our principal objective is right now. We want, in the struggle between Fatah and Hamas, we want those who are national and secular to win that struggle and that competition. Because if the Islamists win the competition, we're going to take what is a national conflict and we're going to make it basically a religious conflict. National conflicts can be really difficult to settle, but they're possible to settle. Religious conflicts you can't settle. So we have a huge stake. So the administration embracing Abu Mazen is understandable, but it can't be the same way it was done before. I guarantee if it's done the way it was done before, money goes to all the wrong people. And the Palestinian public will say, here we go again. Fatah cares only about themselves. The key is to recognize, A, that there are younger members of Fatah, many of whom I just met 3 weeks ago, who are what I call, I should tell you, I met the old guard, the young guard, the third generation and the fourth generation. Now, the young guard, I was a student at one time of the Soviet Union. They had something called the Komsomol, which was the Young Communist League. And, of course, the leader of the Young Communist League was usually aged between 50 and 55, which at the time when I was studying it, I thought was very old. Today, I don't think it's so old. So that's, I don't know. It's funny how your perspective changes. But I met the young guard, who were all roughly 45 to 50. And then I met the third generation, and then I met the fourth generation. So I met people basically between 25 and 45 in the second and third generation. And what I saw, this was 3 weeks ago, what I saw is even before Gaza had collapsed, it was clear it was going to. One reason that was clear is that basically all the Fatah security commanders from Gaza were in Ramallah when I was in Ramallah. Well, the problem wasn't in Ramallah, it was in Gaza. Anyway, all the younger guys that I met, and younger, they were men and women, all of them were focused on learning the lessons and understanding that if they didn't change their behavior, Hamas would take over in the West Bank as well. So they were focused on organizing themselves at the grassroots. They were focused on delivering services at the grassroots. They were basically saying, we have to compete with Hamas the way they competed with us. And I came back, talked to the administration, also talked to all the representatives of the EU in Washington and said, look, these guys proved themselves to me, not just because they understood that they have to be responsible, but when I asked them a question, how are you going to prove, what am I going to say to those in the donor community about guaranteeing that the money will go where it's supposed to go? And they said, have auditors, have whatever transparency mechanisms you want. We don't need it for you. We need it for us. We have to prove to the Palestinian public we're for real. So impose all the conditions you want. Not only that, they were asking for projects that were all what I call in the, you know, $200,000 to $500,000 range. They wanted to create an IT center. They wanted to create summer camps. They wanted to create youth clubs. They wanted to create some free clinics. Everything they were asking for didn't have a high price tag. If I talk to the old guard and I say, what kind of help do you need from the outside? Whereas the young guys were saying, you know, here, they would give me proposals for, you know, $200,000 to $500,000. The old guard would say, well, we need this proposal for $50 million. I mean, not only do they want transparency, but they're asking for practical approaches. Now, these are the people we have to embrace. Now, Salam Fayyad is not a member of Fatah. He's now the new prime minister. But he's someone who very much believes in transparency and reform. We should create conditions for the assistance now because you will strengthen Fayyad's hands. And we should coordinate with him in terms of how you dispense the money and who are the targets and where is it going, principally to the local levels. We should be doing that. That's one way to help Fatah succeed, but it's based on Fatah remaking itself. If it's not going to remake itself, they will not succeed, and it doesn't matter how much more money you pour into it. Now, the Saudis by themselves, they could finance the whole thing. I mean, in 1 week's, you know, 1 week's income, 1 week, 1 day's income, they'd help these guys for a year. So we have to focus on that. We have to do some other things. As it relates to Hamas and Gaza, we have to get the Egyptians to turn off the smuggling tunnels, because the weapons that are going in there are increasingly of longer range rockets. And the longer range the rockets are, sooner or later they're going to hit parts of Israel where the Israeli military won't have a choice. There wasn't a single leader in the Israeli military, and I saw them all when I was there, who wants to go back into Gaza. But there won't be a single leader in Israel that will be able to withstand the pressure if the rockets are going deeper into Israel. But think about where we are right now. Hamas now has to consolidate itself in Gaza, and don't think that's going to be such an easy task. There are 47 different militias in Gaza. If they had such total control in Gaza, they may have vanquished Fatah, but if they had such total control in Gaza, you know, they announced 3 days ago they wanted Alan Johnson, the BBC reporter, to be released. Guess what? He's not been released. So they've got their work cut out for them, number one. They have a place that's completely impoverished, number two, with functional unemployment of 70%. And if they now, they don't have anybody to hide behind. They can't say our problems here are Fatah's. They're responsible. They can't say that. They're there. They kicked them out. They vanquished them. They dragged them through the streets. Threw them off of buildings. You know, they paraded. They looted, you know, the places they took. Okay, it's their show now, at least from that standpoint. They want to be able to develop. They want to show that they can govern effectively. Well, they better play by the rules. We should provide subsistence assistance, humanitarian assistance. There shouldn't be starvation there. But we shouldn't provide any developmental assistance unless they're going to play by the rules. No rockets into Israel. Stop the arms buildup. You don't do that, guess what? You don't get any developmental assistance. So here again, here's an example of where you have leverage. We're not without leverage in this situation. We should be creating a consensus on the criteria for the kind of assistance that will be provided to Gaza right now. That would be an act of statecraft. Yes.
I don't know who better could answer this question, but what do you think the likelihood is of an Israeli preemptive strike against Iran with a nuclear weapon or otherwise?
I think it depends. It depends on whether the Israelis think that the kind of ratcheting up of economic pressure that I described is going to take place. Understand, the clock is ticking. From an Israeli standpoint, there are probably at least two factors that will affect their decision-making. One is where Iran is in the technological development, and it's clear that this is moving ahead. Again, it's the IAEA president, the director of the IAEA, who's saying it, Mohammed Al-Baradei. And the other is something else that people haven't really paid attention to. Russia is upgrading Iran's air defense. So that'll be completed within 18 months. If you're Israel and you're deciding that you're going to have to act militarily, it's through air power. Now, what the Russians are doing will raise the cost dramatically of doing so. So if you're Israel, it's not just the technological clock, it's also that clock. And you're going to act before that capability has been upgraded to the point where it would dramatically raise the cost of you trying to carry this out. So those are two factors that will heavily influence their calculus.
So what do you think they're going to do?
Well, my point is we don't want force to be used because that's a terrible outcome, and we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons because that's a terrible outcome. You better put the pressure on. You better become, you know, much more impatient with the Europeans. You better exploit the kinds of means I was describing. Now, bear in mind, I've said this to the administration. I mean, yes, I've now written it, but I've said it to the administration as well. So I'm hoping they'll act this way. Yes. Right down here. Right here.
I don't want any nation to have nuclear weapons, but I am somewhat confused by our double standard. It seems that India has nuclear weapons, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, Israel has nuclear weapons, and we didn't do anything to prevent them from having nuclear weapons. Why in the world are we acting this way about Iran?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I'm going to give you an answer in a couple of different ways. For the last 25 years. Can I answer it? For the last 25 years, it's a legitimate question. For the last 25 years, there isn't a single Arab leader in the Middle East who didn't think that Israel had nuclear weapons. And nobody in the Arab world felt compelled to go ahead and acquire a nuclear capability. As soon as Iran is on the brink of having nuclear weapons, there are at least three or four Arab states who feel they have to have nuclear weapons. Now, that tells you something. In their case, they may have enmity and conflict with Israel, but they don't think Israel is going to use it. In the case of the Iranians, they fear that Iran is either going to use it or they're going to use it coercively. So it tells you something about the nature of the regime, number one. Number two, you have to look at what Iran is doing in the region right now. What Iran is doing in the region right now is they support movements that are political movements with militias designed to undermine the regimes everywhere in the region. Well, I'm just telling you, you ask a question, you want an answer. I mean, I don't have to answer it. If you want the answer, I'll complete the answer. I mean, I think that people are wrong to challenge you for asking the question, but I think it would be good if you listened to my full answer, too. Now, there's one other factor. I can tell you when I was our negotiator that Iran was pushing all the time to derail what we were doing. We would get information all the time where they actually would create almost like a laundry list. They would send, and these were intercepted from time to time, they were pushing Hamas, Islamic Jihad, to carry out suicide bombings in Israel to undercut our effort to negotiate peace. They would actually have a list where they'd say, kill this many Israelis and you get this much money. Kill twice as many Israelis, you get that much more money. They are acting everywhere, not just to dominate the region, they're acting everywhere to destroy any possibility of creating peace. So that kind of a regime with nuclear weapons should be very unsettling. Last point. Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, reflects an important constituency, as I said, the Revolutionary Guard. Many of them are believers in what's known as the 12th Imam. This was the hidden Imam. Now, in their mysticism, when the 12th Imam appears, he brings justice to humanity. But it's an end-of-days scenario. That's what it is. The 12th Imam appears only after you've had this cataclysm. So you take someone like Ahmadinejad, who believes in this, and you give him the means to pursue this kind of cataclysm. To me, that's just too dangerous. So if you ask me, do I wish, as you put it well, I wish others didn't have the nuclear weapons. I wish they didn't. But I can't undo what exists. And I can see if Iran crosses a threshold, I see what it does internationally. And that price for me is just too high. Now, at the same time, I said, I don't want to have to use force against them because it's going to be a whole set of unintended consequences. So what I want to do is I want to take advantage of the leverage that we have. We need to be smarter about it. And we have the opportunity to do so. Yeah.
Where does Russia fit into all this? Why do they not take a stand? What's to their benefit for Iran to have nuclear weapons?
There is no benefit to Russia for Iran to have nuclear weapons. Why have they adopted the position they have? For a long time, it was just basically because they had some money to be made, they thought. They were building the Bushehr reactor. Now they've actually decided that maybe that's not such a winning proposition after all, because they actually see their real future as being the kind of warehouse to provide fuel to everybody for nuclear reactors worldwide. And what the Iranians may actually cost them. So they're beginning to change their behavior towards the Iranians right now. That's the commercial financial side of it. But there's another side of it. You have in Putin right now someone who wants to restore Russia to great power status. He wants to create an image that they're an alternative to us. He wants to show how basically not only are they independent of us, but they're alternatives to us. So they sell these weapons to the Iranians. They sell weapons right now to the Syrians. It's not like the past during the Cold War, because then they gave the weapons, you know, to gain a position. Now they sell everything. Everything is, you know, is part of making money. But there's an image as well that they want to cultivate, that they are an alternative to us on the international stage. On Iran, I think they've decided they probably played out that string about as far as they can. They've supported the two resolutions, although they're again trying to limit the scope of the resolutions. And I would say there's a potential to change the Russian behavior. But they don't hold a key to Iran when it comes to this issue, because they're not the economic lifeline to Iran. The Europeans and the Japanese. Actually, I'll tell you who the countries are. Germany, Italy, Japan, and India. Three of those four, we have the potential for a lot of leverage. And the Saudis are the key in that respect. All the way in the back. Well, there's three hands in the back. All right. In the middle, in the back. because I did left, I did right, now I'm being in the center. Okay, I thought all the way in the back, but no, you'll be next. Okay.
I saw this morning's paper that Tony Blair is being pulled in after
I can hear it.
Into this mess. What can he do possibly that he hasn't been able to do as prime minister?
This was a question on Tony Blair's being, the administration would like Tony Blair to be working as an envoy on this issue. Well, if he were to throw himself into it, and if he actually had some authority, and that, in a sense, those are two big ifs, by the way, because is this what he's going to do full time? When I say throw yourself into it, you have to act the way I did. You got to be out there all the time. You got to be there basically almost living there. Because this is something that requires a constant involvement. But even if he was there on that basis and he didn't really have authority, the problem is he's going to represent the quartet, meaning the U.S., the EU, the Russians, and the U.N. Now, on the one hand, he represents everybody and nobody because they may not always agree or they'll agree on generalities. What happens if he begins to do something that's controversial? Does he lose support of some of them? What happens if he loses support? I mean, is Bush going to support him in any all circumstances? Can he count on the fact that Bush won't pull the rug out from under him? I mean, I might be a little bit hesitant in his shoes. That's just me talking. The fact is, he is someone who, with the right kind of involvement, with the right kind of authority, he could certainly play the role of building the kind of donor involvement, donor investment. It shouldn't just be assistance. It should be investment as well. Public-private sector investment. He could work very hard in terms of getting Fatah to remake itself. He could apply some of the leverage or the criteria that should be met on what will be applied to Gaza and what won't be applied to Gaza. So he could do a lot in that regard. But the way it's being presented, he would do that and Condi Rice would be the one who would still work on the political horizon. Now, at one level, I would say good, because there's absolutely no chance of a political horizon. So if you're Blair, good deal. The problem is that at this point, you can't look like you have a partial mandate. What I can tell you, when I was a negotiator, nobody questioned whether I had authority or I had a mandate. And the best measure of it is I could raise ideas that I hadn't yet cleared with either the president or the secretary. If you're a negotiator, you have to be in that position. You can't be in a position where you go, you know, can you hold that thought? I got to go make a call. He has to be in a position where his authority is unquestioned and unchallenged. If he had that, he could do some good things. This time, all the way in the back, in the middle. Yes.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about your statecraft, given the parameters that you laid out, and the preset agenda of this present administration before 9/11 to get rid of Hussein. How could this statecraft have come about? I mean, it seems to me it was based on something that was, I guess that is an objective, you know. But then they advanced all these lies and misrepresentations, you know. How could you marry this objective and this means, you know, and be successful? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand.
And can I add something to that? I wanted to know what you know of the relationship between Mossad and Hamas in Hamas's creation. Thank you.
It wasn't Mossad and Hamas. Hamas was, I'll deal with that one first, and then I'll come back to the first question. Hamas was basically created in the mid-1980s. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, it's in Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Syria, and it's, you know, it's an international movement. It's really an outgrowth of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, however, more than anything else. Now, did Israel play a role in the formation of Hamas? To some extent, it did. It made it easier for them to form because the Israelis in the 1980s saw those who were religiously oriented as less nationally oriented. They saw the challenge to them is coming from the PLO, which was a national movement. So at that time, they made it easier for them to build mosques. They made it easier for them to organize. there is a kind of narrative that's out there that said, well, you know, Israel is the one that set up Hamas. They didn't set up Hamas. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, but they made it easier for them to form in the 1980s, thinking that they represented less of a threat than the national movement, and I think obviously that was a mistaken assessment. Now, the administration's coming in on Saddam Hussein. Look, here again I would say there's a little bit of a misnomer. It is true, they were basically in foreign policy when George W. Bush was running, there were really only two issues they ever talked about. One was missile defense, and the other was Saddam Hussein. And yet, when the administration came in, the administration's policies until 9/11 were smart sanctions, not regime change. State Department was running the policy, and it was smart sanctions. The idea of smart sanctions was to change the character of the sanctions regime against Iraq because it was too hard to sustain it. So the idea was to relieve the sanctions on dual-use items and economic items of economic utility, to make it easier for the economy to function within Iraq, to take the pressure off of the population. It was an effort to preserve containment of the Iraqi regime, not to change it. That changed after 9/11. So even though Bush talked about it one way, up until 9/11, basically, that's not what the policy was. I mean, even though it is interesting, when President Clinton saw him, you know, during the transition period, you know, he said at the end of their conversation, listening to Bush, he said, look, I listened to you during the campaign, and it sounded to me like you have two priorities. One is Saddam Hussein, and the other is missile defense. And Bush said, that's right. And Clinton said, look, I think you need to have a different priority. I think you need to have a priority of terrorism and Osama bin Laden. And, you know, the Bush administration came in and they had an ABC policy, which was anything but Clinton. And I think, you know, they didn't much listen to it. So I guess the answer to your question is, I don't think they came in that way. I mean, he had a mindset, but that's not the way they behaved. I think the irony is this was the area where Colin Powell dominated until 9/11. After 9/11, it changed. And, you know, and it changed quickly. You see it in Bush's conversations. I actually have it. I sort of outline what Bush does. Within 72 days, he's asking for a war plan against Iraq, 72 days after 9/11. So after 9/11, that's a traumatic event which has which creates a trauma, understandably, for the administration. But I think it changes fundamentally the mindset of the administration. Down here.
You made an interesting comment earlier. Essentially, you said a religious conflict is not soluble. In the context of Iraq, most now believe that there's an insurgency or a civil war or a sectarian conflict. How would you solve it in terms of statecraft?
So I've now persuaded you that statecraft can solve any problem. I'll tell you how I would do it. Statecraft, again, is based on reality-based assessments. We are at a point in Iraq where what we now have to focus on is preventing the worst from happening. We can't achieve the best. So the first sign of wisdom is understanding the situation we're in. The second is to shape an objective that at least is an important objective and might be achievable. And that objective, for me, is containment. We have to apply what I like to refer to as the Las Vegas rule for Iraq. You know, what goes on in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. Well, what goes on in Iraq has to stay in Iraq. And that means not only a sectarian conflict, but it also means we don't even know who the Osama bin Laden of this conflict is going to be. Osama bin Laden emerged from the Mujahideen conflict against the Soviet Union, and then he went back to Saudi Arabia. Ayman Zawahiri went back to Egypt. We don't even know from this conflict who's going back where. We already know Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, that there's at least a couple hundred of those. This is where the Lebanese have been fighting in the north, in Tripoli. We already know that a couple hundred of them went to Iraq and came back. Well, what do you think they learned? These are the jihadis who went to Iraq and they come back. They're going to be a source of incredible instability in the region. So you better come up with a containment strategy, not only for what's in Iraq, but also for the jihadis coming in and out. Here, you actually have an interesting reality. The reality is that all of Iraq's neighbors, and this includes the Iranians, don't want to see a real convulsion within Iran, within Iraq. None of them can afford it. They will not agree on what they want for Iraq. They can agree on what they fear about Iraq. So focus on a containment strategy designed to limit what's there. It's not satisfying to me because it's not easy to sit on the outskirts and watch a bloodbath take place. It's not morally acceptable. But you got to at least create a baseline objective. The more positive, achievable objective would be a soft partition of Iraq, which in the past would have involved profound ethnic cleansing, except it's already taken place. The population of Iraq when we went in 4 years ago, four and a third years ago now, was 26 million. 4 million people out of 26 million have been displaced. 2 million have left the country. 2 million have left their neighborhoods. So it's the ethnic cleansing, unfortunately, has been taking place. So, you know, try to make a virtue of reality. See if you can manage a process where you'll create soft partition, and your fallback position from that is containment. That would be a statecraft approach. Two more questions. I'm getting a sign for two more questions. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take... Now, I know you're a mother of a student, but you've already had one. But it's a... If your daughter was here, I would take her question. All right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take two questions. I'll hear the two questions, and I'll answer them both. So I'm going to take one in the back by the aisle, all the way in the back, and I'll take... thank you. And I'll take this one over here because I'm going to that side. Anything else you'd like me to do?
You told us there was a timetable to prevent Iran from getting nuclear...
Who's the questioner? I don't see you. Oh, all right. Okay.
Do you think that, and you said that the timetable is less than a year, do you see this administration, which has another year and a half to go, doing what you are proposing or not?
Okay, and the last one? Down here, wait for the mic, please.
I recently heard that Hillary Clinton said at the end of her second term there would be 40,000 U.S. troops remaining in Iraq. I heard Bill Richardson say there would not be a single soldier left in Iraq. I'd be interested in your comments on those two positions.
In the case of the first question, is the administration going to do what is necessary? I don't know, but... You know, Samuel Johnson once said that nothing concentrates the mind like an imminent hanging. And I would say that on Iraq, we're facing an imminent hanging. So let's hope that they will do what is necessary. I certainly have talked to people in the administration who, there was an article I wrote, which is, I was asked to write by the New Republic. I write a biweekly column in New Republic Online. I wrote a column actually in the magazine about 2 months ago, which was a kind of extract from the book in which I laid out what needed to be done, and I got several responses from very senior people in the administration saying that made sense and they were going to try to do it. I just haven't seen it yet. Now, the problem is, as I said, the clock is ticking, but I think there are many people in the administration who I think do get it. So let's hope that the imminent hanging is going to translate into changed behaviors. The question on Iraq is a very interesting one, and it's hard to answer. I'll say why. If you pursue the containment strategy I talk about, it has a military dimension and it has a diplomatic dimension. The military dimension is you basically draw down and you convert, transfer to a training mission. A lot of what the Iraq study group was talking about, which was to end the combat presence, preserve a presence for quick reaction, preserve a presence for dealing with al-Qaeda in Anbar province, basically, but not only there, and focus principally on a training mission. Now, that also is useful, I think, in terms of the containment strategy. How long will it take? What does it mean? In some ways, you're not going to know exactly what that is until you begin to do some of it. The one thing you're going to know is you get out of the middle of a civil war, which is where we are today. We're in the midst of a civil war, and that's simply not sustainable. the diplomatic part of it is to basically help forge deals between the neighbors. I'm not in favor of dealing bilaterally with Iran on Iraq, because that's the worst possible way to do it. That tells them we need them to pull our chestnuts out of the fire. Well, you think they're going to do that? They're going to impose a high price on us, and it's not going to be clear what we get in return. What I want is to cut a deal between the Saudis and the Iranians on Iraq, because the Iranians will look at the Saudis funding the Sunnis as a potential threat to them, and the Saudis will look at the Iranians funding the Shiite militias as being a potential threat to them. So play upon what are their respective fears and help to broker a deal among all the neighbors. None of them. The Syrians don't have an interest in Iraq falling apart. They certainly don't have an interest in the jihadis coming back into Syria, because guess what? The Muslim Brotherhood is the alternative to this regime. So it's not as if, again, here, if you understand how to do statecraft, one of the things you understand is you understand leverage. You understand vulnerabilities. And unfortunately, the weakness of this administration has been not just the faith-based assessments, but if you do faith-based assessments, you don't understand well enough where those vulnerabilities and points of leverage are. You also don't understand your own vulnerabilities well enough, and you better. Thank you very much. I will sign some books.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.